Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Congressional races in central New York are often considered bellwethers for the nation. My guest this week is a political scientist who's looked very closely at the 2018 midterm elections in this region. Luke Perry is a professor in the Department of Government and Politics at Utica College and the director of the Utica College Center of Public Affairs and Election Research. He's also the author of a book titled Donald Trump and the 2018 Midterm Battle for Central New York. Luke, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So as political scientists, of which we both are, we all follow the local congressional races, but I was curious to know, what prompted you to want to write an entire book about it?
That's a great question. So I originally got into election studies through journalism as someone who wanted to try to give back and serve local media organizations by providing insights here and there. I started working with WKTV out of Utica, and I was a correspondent at both of the national party conventions in 2016, at President Trump's inauguration, at the Women's March, and so on. And obviously their media market spans more than one congressional district, so they were interested in getting analysis not only of the home district, which was NY22, but NY19 as well. And so I began learning more about not only my own district, but the neighboring districts. And I think it is a really interesting geographic area for thinking about the Trump presidency and how he was going to do and the Republicans were going to do after the first midterm.
So we'll get into the book as we go and different parts of it. But first, how did you set your book up? You mentioned two districts right there, but what races did you look at, and what part of the election cycle, if any, did you focus on?
I focused on the 2018 midterm, and the question for me was looking at three incumbent Republicans in central New York. So that would be John Faso in NY19, Claudia Tenney in NY22, and John Katko in NY24. And obviously, there was anticipation that the Democrats were going to gain seats in 2018, the Republicans were going to lose seats. The big question was, where is that going to happen? And central New York was a battleground front. And so those three districts and those three races I looked closely at throughout the 2018 campaign and then through the results on Election Day.
So did you also examine the nomination process for the challengers? You started early looking at fundraising and so on?
Yeah, so it looks at first the districts because, as you know, we've had redistricting here this decade. So it's a relatively new set of boundaries that we're dealing with. So I looked at redistricting. I looked at the partisan composition and dynamics in each of these districts. And then I looked very closely and tried to document in good detail what happened during the campaign in terms of issues, in terms of fundraising, in terms of the debates, in terms of the approaches that the candidates took. And then lastly, tried to provide analysis in terms of what happened, who won, and why.
So what were, and we'll get into some of the specific elements of the things you just mentioned here in a few minutes, but what were the most central findings and the main arguments of your book?
Well, I think one of the most interesting ones is the Donald Trump presidency, of course. And what does that mean for the Republican Party? That's a big national question. It's also a question here regionally in our part of New York. And I think that what I found was that Donald Trump enthused Republicans, particularly in 2016, but come 2018, he also divided Republicans. Mm-hmm. And each of these three incumbent Republicans had to determine what their strategy was going to be to navigate the Trump presidency. And you had three very different approaches. Claudia Tenney aligned herself very closely with the president in terms of style and substance.
She said she was Trump before Trump was Trump.
Correct. Yes. Yes. That ultimately was what I call a high-risk, high-reward strategy. And we can talk more about what happened in regards to the outcome in a bit.
Okay.
John Katko voted consistently with Republicans for the most part, but had a targeted distancing from the president when it came to issues of the Justice Department, when it came to Russia. And John Faso, he was kind of caught up in the middle. He was never comfortable with Donald Trump and ultimately kind of got swept up by the blue wave. And he was the only of the three afterwards, after losing his seat, who was really outspoken about what he believed to be the negative effects of the Trump presidency on the Republican Party, the election outcomes in 2018 and beyond. So you had, these three incumbents trying to navigate this issue. They did it in different ways with different levels of results.
So one question that I was curious about in this regard was whether tenure in office mattered. This is a kind of a rule of thumb of congressional races that political scientists sometimes invoke, that, if you can win your first reelection, the next ones get a lot easier. That's certainly true also at the state level. And CATCo was running for his third term, and both Tenney and Faso were running, I believe, for their first re-elections. So do you think that played a role in it?
Of course. So from a political science perspective, this is comparative analysis, but a very small sample. I'm just comparing the three cases, right? So there's only so much I can extrapolate. But certainly that was an advantage for CATCo. As you know, he won quite handily twice before. And even though this recent race was closer, he had the base built to be able to navigate a political storm in a way that the other two House incumbents, Faso and Tenney, as freshmen, were less able to. So that was certainly a consideration in understanding how he succeeded and they failed in terms of winning re-election.
So tell me more about, you mentioned Tenney's high-risk, high-reward strategy. Tell me more about what you learned about that.
Well, I think, you know, covering particularly the NY22 race closely, both as a journalist and then honestly interested as a scholar as well, you know, I had a really front row view on all the major developments and contacts within the different campaigns. And, you know, what I learned about Republicans in that district is that on paper, it looks like a shoo-in for re-election. They have a 30,000 Republican advantage in NY22 that's been steady over the last several election cycles. And so, you know, obviously if you're a Republican, you're generally feeling pretty good, particularly if you're incumbent. You mentioned tenure, but as you also know, incumbency advantage is very significant in House races. Over 90% of the time, on average, House incumbents are re-elected. So you've got an incumbent Republican in a heavily Republican district. The challenge of the Trump presidency was that, as I mentioned, Republicans were divided. And in NY22, I put them into three categories. One-third, approximately, were diehard Trump supporters, enthusiasts, right? They liked everything that the president has done. And, of course, they're going to support Tenney and people like Trump, akin to Tenney. Then you had the second third that are what I call the hold-your-nose voters. They're Republicans. They like the policies coming out of the unified Republican government between 2016 and 2018, tax cuts, deregulation, a more conservative court, military spending. They like all these things, but they don't really care for the personality or antics of Donald Trump. But they'll hold their nose and vote for him and Republicans because they like the policy outcomes. Then the last third, which I don't think gets a lot of attention nationally or even locally for that matter, are Republicans who do not care for Donald Trump. They don't want someone who is a tweeting TV star trying to run the country. They crave competence. They tend to be more moderate. They tend to be less partisan. And they don't have much faith in him or people like him. And it's that last third that I think were pivotal in understanding why Tenney lost and Brindisi won in a very close election, because Anthony Brindisi was somebody that people, particularly in the northern part of NY22, know because he's from Utica. He's been assemblyman for several years. And that last third, Tenney could never really get them in the fold, and I think that helped cost the election for.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Utica College professor Luke Perry, and we're talking about the congressional races in central New York. On that last point, it seemed to me that what Brindisi had in his favor for that last third is, at least in policy position and ideological positioning, the move that last third had to make to vote for him wasn't terribly big, at least in comparison to some other Democrats running. Does that seem right to you? Do you think that was important? That if I'm actually going to pull the lever for someone else, the question is, how far am I willing to go to do that? And Brindisi kind of positioned himself so that it didn't feel like such a reach.
I completely agree. And he, you know, one of the tactical parts of the strategy was to seek the Independence Party nomination early on. And he knew that that would be necessary to, one, build his moderate credentials, and two, to produce several thousand votes that would be determinative, perhaps, in a close election. So he very much, from day one, has tried to position himself as someone who was moderate. And then, you know, to win, he was able to flip Oneida County, which is home to Utica and the most populated county in NY22, and Tenney's home turf. So it helped him both in terms of messaging and presenting himself as a candidate, and then it also helped him in terms of delivering the votes he needed to win, which was, you know, taking on Tenney on her home turf and defeating her.
Was Faso hurt by the fact that, and I think I've got this right, my memory is correct, that when he had beaten Teachout to win the seat, that was a pretty bare-knuckled contest, as I recall. Was there a way in which she sort of established, a beachhead of negative messaging that maybe people remembered 2 years later when a different candidate then was trying to take him on?
Well, I think for Fassel, the ground shifted underneath him in terms of registered partisans. So it was a slightly Republican district, and then in a relatively short period of time, there's been an influx of Democrats there. And part of that, and a related consideration, is because of grassroots liberal organizing. So you talk to grassroots liberal organizers there. One thing they tried to do was to get people who live in New York City predominantly but have a second home in NY19 to register as voters in NY19. That wasn't the only factor, but it shows how, you know, the organizing was pivotal. And so you have the district shifting under his feet, becoming more Democratic at a time when he's got an uncomfortable relationship with the president. And we have to remember, both John Katko and John Fassel did not vote for Donald Trump.
Right.
So they are not diehard supporters. They're Republicans trying to make sense of what the Trump presidency means for Republicans. So, you know, he had this sort of arm's length relationship with the president, which didn't help him with diehard Republicans. Democrats were enthused. And becoming more, you know, voters were becoming more Democratic, so they weren't crazy about him. So he's trying to carve out this middle ground that ultimately just wasn't effective for him.
Now, did anything that you saw or the outcomes in any way surprise you, given what you know as a political scientist and what you were seeing on the ground? Did anything just, I didn't see that coming?
That's a very interesting question. I think, one of the messages that I've been left with is that, and I think of congressional campaign committees and how they identify competitive seats and what they do, they take a very surface-level analysis of things. And I'm a critic of congressional campaign committees, as you can maybe tell by that lead-in. And these, you know, certain races look close on paper, but then when you have, you know, a view on the ground of them, it's really not that close. So as a political scientist, I look at NY22, I say, well, there's a significant registered Republican advantage. There's an incumbent. Incumbents get elected over 90% of the time. Also, Donald Trump at the time in 2016 was very popular, won by 16 points. If you didn't understand the dynamics of the race and what was going on behind the scenes, you would say, well, this isn't going to be close. Claudia Tenney is going to be reelected by 5 or 8 points. And the fact is, the experience showed that wasn't the case, because there was a lot more going on than just sort of the basic metrics that are often used. So that's one thing that I was kind of left with. You know, we nationalize these elections, which makes sense because they are, in some, a national election. But each one is an individual race, and the dynamics are different, and it may really challenge what conventional wisdom is on paper.
So with Tenney, then, it sounds like part of what you're saying is there's a candidate quality issue. I mean, a lot of the things that she said were sometimes pretty out there, and they got a lot of attention.
Yes. Yeah, so she certainly made national, international news for being controversial during the race and in certain ways in terms of comments about mass shooters being Democrats and these types of things. And certainly that doesn't help her. One thing I found was that people in these three races voted for who they liked, right? Katko, Brindisi, and Delgado all had higher favorability. And you had, you know, Representative Tenney and Fassel underwater leading up to Election Day. It's just not going to work.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Luke Perry, a professor at Utica College and the author of a book titled Donald Trump and the 2018 Midterm Battle for Central New York. All right. We've been talking about 2018, and you've dissected that. Now let's think about 2020 because, gee, it already started a long time ago. So what's most striking you about the way that the congressional races in central New York, and if you want to take the three districts again, that's fine. How are they shaping up this time around? What's striking you most about the way they're shaping up?
That's a fun thing about elections, isn't it? You're always looking back and looking forward at the same time, even though it's quite some time until Election Day. I think what I'm seeing in these three districts right now is not a lot of strong challengers to the people that are in office, right? Mm-hmm. You look at NY22, for instance. You've got three candidates, Republicans, vying.
And the incumbent there, just to remind our listeners, is?
Anthony Brindisi.
Okay.
Right? So there's the three Republican challengers, and one of them is comes out of Broome County, the second largest county in the district, and is a DA, has a bit of a political base, but he's never run for national office before. Another has run several times unsuccessfully and is not thought of as someone who's going to be able to get over the heap this time, and then you have a newcomer who's never run before and doesn't seem to have much of the choice. And then Claudia Temme's kind of looming. Mm-hmm. She may run. I think it's more likely than not she'll probably declare unless she lands a job in Washington. But again, given what we talked about previously, I think the Brindisi campaign would welcome a rematch now that they're, you know, in power, have the incumbency advantage on their side, or bringing home the bacon and already beat her once. So, you know, I look at that. I look at NY19, same thing. You've got three Republicans.
And that's the incumbent there.
Yep, that's Antonio Delgado.
Okay.
And he's, again, similarly, three candidates, all political newcomers, you know, not a political base, name recognition, fundraising ability, the things that you would correlate with. With success. And so then finally, district here, NY24, Dana Balter obviously is running again. She's run before, so I think she could build on her success. But it's going to be probably a competitive primary with two other candidates who are vying for that. And the challenge that Balter faced is in the first time around, the primary set her back a little bit because it was a competitive primary and the DCCC got involved and hampered her ability to raise money. And then when that was out of the way, she raised a lot of money. And, you know, she has certain strengths, not only the experience of running, but I thought she did a particularly good job in the debates. But the challenge she's going to face is, you know, she built her name recognition, but coming down the stretch in 2018, the more people knew of her, the more her favorability fell. So I think that's one thing. There doesn't seem to be, at this point, particularly strong candidates in these three districts that are well-positioned to displace the people in power.
On that point, when you noted that the more that voters learned about Dana Balter, then her numbers went down, do you think that she is a good ideological fit for the 24th district?
I think it's a challenge. You know, you look at, again, it's the very beginnings of the campaign, so I don't certainly want to make too much of it or say that it's fully developed at this point. But economic populism, for instance, is a heavy theme that Democratic NY24 candidates are emphasizing. In a district that is more Democratic by about 14,000 people on paper, but also has a strong Conservative Party contingent that relatively equals that out, I think CATCO's been successful by positioning himself as someone who is more independent and more moderate and securing the Independence Party nomination. And then you've got the Democratic candidates who are coming farther to the left. And if, you know, Balter, to her credit, obviously she closed the gap. CATCO was winning by 20 points. She was beat by about 5 points. So that's significant. But if you're going to take that next step, I think, as you asked, ideologically, if you're too far to the left, that's going to be difficult to get those more moderate, both Republicans and Democrats on your side, to win.
Because Dan Maffei was always trying to emphasize that he was a moderate, and he had trouble sometimes making that message stick. I also wondered on this 24th district race whether, and this is kind of a complicated one, I'll try to simplify it, but when she ran last time, the expectation was that the House would shift over to Democratic control, but it hadn't happened yet. So she was running as part of this wave. All right, now that's happened. And then we are contemplating now the real possibility, of course, in 2020, that the White House could go under Democratic control. So I wonder whether that changes the appeal of her as a candidate if she stays in roughly the same ideological position, because on the one hand, originally, one might see these things as almost protest votes or signals. Now this stuff is real. You know, this kind of health care proposal is real. This kind of gun control proposal is real. It's not just a hypothetical anymore. And I wonder whether that would change things in people's minds or whether they think that strategically or deeply about it.
That's a very interesting question. So one of the big unknowns looking at the congressional elections in terms of 2020 is what's the impact of Donald Trump going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's optimism on the right that with him atop the ticket that the Republican turnout will be higher. Now, in central New York, it was still pretty high. Obviously, a midterm election turnout is not going to be the same as a presidential election. But, turnout last time was higher than normal, and not just for Democrats who are enthused. So I'm a little skeptical that there's going to be a big influx of Trump-supporting voters really changing the dynamics. In terms of the control of government, you know, my initial reaction is it's been really helpful that the government's divided right now for people like Representative Brindisi and Representative Delgado, because whatever they do is going to be blocked by Republicans anyway. So they can buck their party, and it doesn't actually hurt them, but it makes them look good with voters. And so I think for them, particularly Brindisi, it's not going to be overly challenging to be reelected in 2020. But if, as you mentioned, there's a Democratic president that's elected, and you know the Senate's obviously too close to call at this point. But if those, my point is, if there's those votes tend to mean more in terms of policy implications, and then you're dealing with a midterm of the Democratic president, and you're in a Republican district, that's the real danger there. But in terms of healthcare, for instance, I do think Dana Balter carved out a position more to the left than the other three Democratic challengers in 2018. Mm-hmm. She supported Medicare for all then. Unlike Delgado, who was sort of wanting a public option and focusing on that, and Brindisi, who had a pretty muddled message. It was a missed opportunity for Tenney to kind of call him out because he was kind of all over the place there, knowing that he was in a bit of a sticky position. So if Medicare for all continues to become popular, and that's what the Democrats run on nationally, maybe it helps Balter. I'm a little skeptical at this point. When it gets to the general election, that's going to be the case, but that's yet to be determined.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Utica College professor Luke Perry. One more question about the 24th here, and that is the DCCC, and at least one media outlet anyway, I think, are suggesting that John Katko either wants to retire or may retire before the 2020 election. Are you hearing anything more locally about that?
I don't have any inside information in terms of that. You know, I suspect it's an effort to try to cast doubt on Katko's long-term appeal. Right? Because if he's someone who's demonstrated that he can win under Republican administrations and Democratic administrations. So if you're a congressional campaign committee, however you can, you want to conjure up doubt that, oh, this person's not going to be around. I'm not going to waste my vote and vote for him. But, you know, he said he's running, and so that's where we're at right now.
He certainly raised a lot of money for someone who's not running.
Right. So, you know, he did recognize and was fairly candid after the 2018 election. This was the closest, you know, challenge he's got. And, you know, Balter ran a tough race. I would be surprised if he wouldn't run again. You never know. Maybe there's been in recent cycles an influx of retirements in the House. And so that may happen, of course. But I don't think there's any reasons in terms of his reelection prospect for him to sit this out.
You just mentioned something really in passing there, and it triggered something in my head. So I'm going to go back again, if you don't mind. But you mentioned what John Katko said on election night about the closeness of the election. I remember his speech. I also remember Claudia Tenney's speech. If we were counting up things that surprised us, I'm just curious your reaction about her non-concession speech on the night. I thought it was a little bit strange. I'm just curious
what you... The whole situation is strange. You're absolutely right. So I was on the air, WKTV, doing election analysis, and then, you know, the major news organizations are calling the race in favor of Brindisi, but I want to say there was something about 1,200 votes that separated the two candidates, and there were, you know, absentee ballots and stuff that haven't been counted. So the national organizations, I think, were a little quick in terms of giving it to Brindisi, and then he gives a short sort of a victory speech, and then Tenney has to decide what she wants to do, and she's kind of acknowledging that things didn't go well, and she's disappointed, but she's also not conceding, you know, and saying that she's going to give up. And so then it led to, you know, 4 or 5, 6 more weeks of actually counting all those votes, and Brindisi actually expanded his lead. And credit to his campaign, he had a former election commissioner who was Jordan Karp, who was on his campaign team, who left nothing to chance. And they worked diligently, anticipating a close election, to make sure that they could maximize their potential voter turnout when it came to absentee votes. And so they felt pretty strong based on their groundwork. And sure enough, it turned out that way.
Now, the race that you didn't write about was the one that featured incumbent Elise Stefanik. And that's the 21st district, right?
Correct.
Yeah. It seems to me, as just an observer, that she's kind of walked that seat up. And she seems to fit the district party registration polling numbers pretty well. What's your sense of that?
It's very insightful that you mentioned that, because that was initially going to be one of my cases. And then, as you know, as a scholar, there's only so much you can do in the time that you have. And so because I didn't anticipate that being particularly close, I cut it. And I think that it's worthwhile. You know, I do different spots with statewide news organizations. And, you know, there are some in the political science community in New York statewide who think that the whole state is going to go Democratic as, you know, the polarization nationally comes to New York. And that district is the one that I always think about. I'm like, well, you know, I got the North Country. That's not changing anytime soon. You've got somebody who's been able to navigate the Trump presidency. She's Representative Stefanik, you know, worked with Paul Ryan, worked with George W. Bush. She's still been able to cultivate sufficient Trump support. She hasn't deviated too much from him, but isn't an outspoken supporter of President Trump. So she's navigated all that beautifully in terms of, you know, being able to secure her seat. So I agree.
We've only got a couple minutes left, but I want to squeeze in this last topic here. Let's think about the Democratic presidential nomination race right now and how that's shaping up. Do you have any specific thoughts or reactions so far on where that's going? And I have one last thing I want to try to squeeze in on that. So,
I think from an upstate New York perspective, someone more like Biden would be more advantageous mm-hmm. for Representative Brindisi and Delgado. Brindisi voted for Biden for Speaker of the House in kind of the symbolic vote, and he said he wouldn't vote for Nancy Pelosi, so he votes for Biden. So, yeah, I mean, if someone like Elizabeth Warren secures the nomination, I think it certainly elevates Republican chances. And recently, you know, Representative Brindisi has expressed his concern to Speaker Pelosi behind closed doors and closed-door meetings about how impeachment is becoming an increasing focus for the Democratic campaign generally, both in the presidential race and the House races, and that's something that Brindisi's opposed consistently, and it creates challenge. So, you know, I've always wondered, is there going to be that vote that someone like Brindisi or Delgado is going to have to take that's really going to be challenging? And we haven't seen it yet because of divided government, but I think on that front it could happen.
Just a few seconds left. Do you think that there might be a candidate in the field who could emerge as the compromise for the Democrats between the Sanders-Warren wing and the Biden wing? Is there someone that could run in the middle of those two?
Nationally or in terms of upstate?
Nationally.
Yes, I think you think of people like Senator Harris or Pete Buttigieg. I mean, they're trying to carve out that now. They just don't have the name recognition or support at this point. But it's going to be a long campaign, as you know, so it's possible.
We will see. That was Luke Perry. Luke, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.